Hey everybody, this is Paul Franklin and you're listening to Walking the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, señores and señoritas. This is Chris Shiflett. And once again, you are listening to America's favorite podcast, Walking the Floor. How are you out there in podcast land? I am a sick man, ladies and gentlemen, a sick, sick man. I have an incurable case of World Cup fever. Come on. As you all probably know, America didn't qualify for World Cup, so normally my go-to is Germany. But I drew Spain in our World Cup betting pool out here on tour, so viva España. Come on, boys. Anyhow, I wanted to give you all a quick update. If you follow my Twitter, you would probably be aware that when we were in Gothenburg on tour a couple of weeks ago, I sent my laundry out to get done. The laundromat accidentally gave all my clothes to some guy named Ted, or we thought his name was Ted, a guy from Australia. Turns out his name's Adam. Adam from Australia, who I think is some sort of like, he's a boxer or something, went back to Australia with all my laundry the next day, didn't have his SIM card in his phone because he was traveling, stuck it back in, and was probably bombarded by like a million text messages and phone messages from the promoter, the laundromat, like our production people, blah, 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 blah. And anyway, I'm happy to say he got back in touch with us and he's sending my laundry home. Yes! And once I kind of inspected what was left of my clothes, I realized that I hadn't actually lost my Willie Nelson shirt or my Tom Curran socks, but there's probably some good stuff in there that I don't even know, you know, went missing. And I'm going to be happy to get it back, so thank you, Adam, the drunk Australian from Australia, who's going to send my stuff home. I appreciate it. Oh, by the way, also, a couple days after that, Air France lost the rest of my luggage, so... It was a little touch and go on tour there for a couple days. I had some bad clothing luck. Did y'all see the Guns N' Roses special guest appearance with the Foo Fighters over there in Florence? I gotta say, one of the great musical moments of my whole life. That was like my teenage dreams come true. And I know there's that internet rumor out there that never goes away that I auditioned for Guns N' Roses, which never happened, isn't true at all, no truth to it, but I did get lots of comments on my social media like, hey, you finally joined Guns N' Roses. And then at the end of it, I was so stoked at the end of it, I just went to go hug Slash, and I knocked his hat right off. So sorry about that, buddy. Sorry I knocked your hat off. That was silly and unintentional. All right, let's sell some gear. Let's talk about Zounds.com. You love Zounds.com. It's your one-stop shopping for all your musical gear needs. And, you know, they have free shipping on every single order. No exceptions, no exclusions. Most orders arrive within 2 days. And you can go over to the Zounds.com blog and get caught up on all the previous episodes of Walking the Floor. Also, support for Walking the Floor comes from Diodario. Diodario, a fine maker of USA-made instrument strings and musical accessories, is committed to sustainability through the Playback program, recycling over 1 million used instrument strings. For more information on the Playback program and how to help in its mission of reaching 2.5 million strings in 2018, please visit diodario.com/playback. All right, let's get to this week's interview.
Together again, my tears have stopped falling.
I love the pedal steel guitar. To me, it's like the magic sauce in country music. It's the frosting on top of the song cake. And Paul Franklin is one of the absolute masters of the pedal steel, an instrument that is so complex, it's been known to drive men insane. We actually address that issue right off the top in this interview.
Paul Franklin carries on the tradition of guys like Buddy Emmons and Lloyd Green while always moving the instrument forward. As a matter of fact, he's recently started his own online steel course for all you young bucks out there who want to learn the trade. Just be careful. I'll put that link up on walkinthefloor.com so you can check it out. If you aren't familiar with his name, you have undoubtedly heard his steel on countless records. In fact, when I asked him to name some of the artists he's played with over the years, he said it'd be easier to name the ones he hasn't played with instead. From his humble beginnings in Detroit, learning Hawaiian lap steel and sitting in with grown men around town in the honky-tonks, to becoming one of Nashville's top session players, to recording with Megadeth, to touring the world with the likes of Vince Gill and many others, this is Paul Franklin on Walking the Floor.
We're together again.
So steel players are renowned for all being totally insane.
Well,
what is it about this instrument that drives people crazy?
Well, it's extremely logical. It makes no sense. You know, when you start tearing apart, you go, oh, well, I didn't see it. But you can't, there's so much that, like on a guitar, you sit down and you can kind of make a chord and strum strings.
Right.
And you get music. And the instrument's tuned, the steel's tuned triadic. So, but it's got these odd notes. Like there's a flat 7 and a major 7.
Mm.
So there's three half tones apart. So when you hit it with all the strings, you say, well, I can't even strum a chord. It doesn't sound right.
Right. Yeah, yeah. How did that develop? Like, where did that come from? Because that seems was that in those sorts of tunings in place before the pedals were added?
No. It evolved. There's several people involved, but mostly Buddy Emmons. Buddy added the two outside, you know, like for you guitar players out there, the first note's F sharp, then it's like a D sharp or E flat, then it goes to a G sharp. So it's like instead of just, you would think it would just go diatonic, like from the highest to the lowest, but it doesn't, which is odd for any instrument. And so then it goes to a G sharp, then E, B, G sharp, F sharp, E, D, and B. Okay.
Did he just keep adding strings as he was trying to like figure out new chord shapes and stuff?
Yeah, exactly. First pedal steels were probably 8 strings, you know. Well, the first ones actually went way back to the 30s. And yeah, the first pedal steels were...
Because they weren't really used in country music till what, like the mid-50s or something?
The 50s is when the bending sound of the pedals, which is, that was the lightning rod.
Right,
you know,
right,
but
right.
Up until then, what happened was guys were there was an Oahu method. And like Buddy Emmons and Lloyd Green would tell you that they were at their house and a door-to-door salesman knocks on a door and says, does anybody here want to learn Hawaiian steel guitar? I mean, they had this massive, and it was like a mail order college.
Mm.
So they taught, that school taught everybody from when you look at the older the people that inspired me. They taught them the lap steel tuning. So
who were the guys that inspired you?
Well, Buddy Emmons and Jimmy Day, Lloyd Green, Weldon Marek, Rusty Young, you know, anybody that could hear during the time. Now, Rusty and I are probably not that far apart in age, but I heard of, you know, it was cool because he was playing on Poco's records back in the 60s, and there were all these, you know, Dylan was experimenting with the steel and all that. So I had a lot of those. I'm from Detroit, so I had a lot of those influences. But Buddy Emmons essentially... there was an E tuning, like, you know, straight E triadic. He said, oh, well, this would be great if it had put F sharps in there, you know, give it an open without pedals. The pedals go from 1 to 4, the very first steel. And then he started adding all the, because he's very musical. So he said, oh, we need a 6 and we need a 9, we need a 7, and we need both a dominant 7th and a major 7. And he kind of added all the extra notes and,
That's a fascinating time, like in music history, because it seems like all the guys that were around back then, regardless of your instrument, were tinkerers, guys that were not only players but could like build and revolutionize the gear.
Yeah, well, like going back to Les Paul,
sure,
you know, like and you know, he had a strong influence into this whole town, as he did all the towns, but Les Paul had a country connection, and through Chet and Les Paul were great friends. And then there was Billy Bird, who played with Ernest Tubb, and then he came up with the Bird. He helped Gibson come up with the Birdland guitar.
Oh, that's where that comes from.
Yeah, that's where that comes from. It's Jimmy, actually, after Billy Bird. And if you listen to, since you're walking the floor, Ernest Tubb, he'll say, "Oh, Billy Bird now."
Right, yeah, right.
And that's where that came from.
I didn't know that's where that came from. Billy Bird. Straight from him, that's a straight line to Ted Nugent.
Yeah, there you go. But anyway, long story short, I won't wear everybody out on all this tedious stuff, but pedals came in to be when the Wahoo Method, they were teaching all these tunings. Like, hey, if you want a 13, there was an E13th, there was this tuning. So because you had to really, it's like a dobro. If you just tuned it to a straight triad, then you couldn't make a lot of chords. So they would work up tunings to play specific songs. I want to play diminished chords, so I needed this tuning. And so the steels got wider and wider. They went from one to two to three necks to four necks. Now you're looking like Frankenstein trying to play this thing.
They were four necks.
Oh, there were five necks. They went up to five necks.
That's great. And then how was that to tune for a gig, man?
I have no idea. Thank God I didn't go through that school. But
yeah, were all those guys like, were they all like a bunch of guitar players before they picked up that Oahu Method? Was that how it kind of started?
I think, Lloyd Green was not, and I'm not sure if Buddy played a little guitar or what before that, but it was just, you got to remember, America was infatuated with Hawaiian.
Mm-hmm.
We were getting ready to have another state.
Yeah.
There, people were having luau's and all this stuff.
So, right.
And we had Coconut Grove and Harbor Lights were
tiki
hits.
Tiki culture, man.
All that stuff on the radio. So it wasn't that far-fetched that, hey, learn to play the Hawaiian guitar.
It's so exotic.
Yeah, and they look cool. Have you, you've seen the magazines where put together. Yeah. You know, there's probably 50 different brands.
Yeah, yeah.
And they all look like really great art.
Yeah, to look
at it with it.
I love those old guitars with like the palm trees and stuff.
Painted on.
Yeah. Great. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what brought your family to Detroit?
Well,
where were your folks from?
They're from 90 miles from Lawrenceburg, Tennessee, in that area.
Okay.
Which is about 90 miles south of here.
Did
Nashville.
They move up there for the auto industry jobs?
Yeah, they moved because of the Depression. You know, there was an iron mill thing going on in that area, and it was pretty prosperous. But then when the Depression hit, and the war and all that stuff, it just disintegrated any hopes of income there. So they all, my dad's family all moved to Detroit and Chicago. So that's how I ended up there. And I thank God we did, because I also got in my background, growing up as a kid, hearing all the soul. They called it soul, not R&B back then.
Right, right.
And all that was birthed, even though I wasn't playing, it was like really evolving. And then once I started at eight, I had that along with Buck Owens and Hank Sr. and all that stuff in my household.
And your dad built your first pedal steels, right?
Yeah, well, he built my... I actually ordered a Fender 400. My Hawaiian teacher, she said, "Oh, I don't play pedals." She said, "I'm going to teach this kid how to teach himself." Because she was a master. I now know how good she was. I was having Jerry Bird teach me, who was the everybody arguably will say he's the greatest lap steel player of all time.
Right, right.
And with his skill set. So anyway, she taught me how to play. But then my dad would take me over to see Ernest Tubb or whoever, and try to meet the steel player. And back in those days, you could get to the artist. So backstage, I'd set up this Fender 400. And before I'd even play, they say, "You got to get this kid off this guitar." Because they were obsolete back then. Because you can't, on a cable-pulled guitar, on the Fenders, you can't pull, sharpen a note and lower the same note, a string. Or lower the string. So therefore, it's limited, very limited, what the guitar doing. Nashville players are already lowering and raising the same strings.
So pedal steel technology by that time was accelerating fast changing rapidly, I'm guessing.
Almost faster than the players,
right?
You know, because
was your dad a pedal steel player?
How did
he wind up being the one building your gear?
Well, he was the out of necessity when that happened. He didn't know.
He a musician at all?
No, he didn't know. But all he knew was all these great artist steel players were saying, "Get this kid off this guitar,"
right,
and he thought, And my Hawaiian teacher was telling him, man, this kid is really accelerating. He's learning, you know.
Right.
Like,
and why so do you my think dad, you were so focused? And I say this, you know, with I'm just kind of self-referencing my own, you know, struggles to get my kids to practice their guitar lessons and stuff. Yeah. And I was a terrible student myself when it came to practicing. Mm-hmm. Why do you think at such a young age you were so focused on your instrument? And such an odd musical choice for a kid.
Yeah, well, it's weird. It's because my dad was a baby of 14 kids.
Mm.
And so all of my cousins played all the cool instruments, drums. And I think I was just a rebellious...
The steel was the last one left.
Yeah, it was exactly that. I didn't love it. But right. I knew my dad used to, you know, point out he loved the sound of steel. Like when Slowly came out and all those things. Mm. Listen to that steel guitar.
Yeah.
And so when my cousins were all playing all these instruments... And I was just eight. And my dad said, "Hey, you want to play?" And it's like I wanted outside the backyard to play ball,
right?
You know,
yeah, yeah.
And so I wasn't really focused, and but I took to it. It was easy.
Hmm.
I don't know what it was about that instrument.
Just made sense.
It just made sense to me, and I no rhyme or reason. And so anyway, my dad fast forward that once he found out that. Got to get this kid off the guitar. Back in those days, Showbud and Emmons and all the great manufacturers of the time sent out brochures showing why their guitar was better than the next one because ours works this way. And so he had all these books and he just looked.
They're giving away their secrets.
Exactly. No trade secrets. And he built one. My uncle had a body shop, so he had all the tools that he needed.
Yeah.
And first one was so-so. The second one was really innovative.
Have you held on to those over the years?
I got the second one. And I played the second one on a Martina McBride record, Timeless. She went back to cut. She cut Ernest Tubb's song, I got to think, Thanks a Lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I used that guitar on that one. She said, I want an old steel. I said, I've got one.
I got just the thing.
I got the one for that.
Have you managed to hold on to your gear from over the years? Like, because you would have started, I mean, I know you were a kid, but you were active as a kid. So did you have some cool stuff in, you know, through that period in the 60s? Have you held on to any of that stuff?
I had all kinds of cool stuff, but what I tell everybody these days.
Get rid of all that old stuff. I got all this cool new digital stuff.
Yeah. I got rid of everything, and that's horrible. And so now I tell all my students, you know, if it's not eating, don't sell it.
Right. Well, now you have the opportunity. You can buy it back at like, you know, 100 times the price.
Oh, yeah.
You paid
well,
for
I wish.
It.
I wish that was the case. But you know, I have a, you know, I bought back. I'm still looking for an MSA like the one I had when I first moved to town. But I've got a Showbud. Mm. Vince found a Showbud that my father had built.
Right.
And so and when we did the Bakersfield record, then he, you know, he surprised me with that. He
said, wow,
and it was
nice.
Great. It was the first year that my dad worked at Showbud, and
wow.
And so I've got that, and I just recently bought a an Emmons push pull bolt on they call them, and so I've got one of those. That's the kind of guitar that I had when I played with an Emmons, and so. Now I've got at least I can look at my thing and go, yeah, I want to see the stair steps, you know, how I got to where I am.
I don't associate Detroit with country music much.
Yeah.
Was there a country music, was there like a honky-tonk scene there back when you were a kid growing up?
Yeah.
I mean, it would make sense, I guess, because people moved there, you know, from all over. And
well, it's on a grid, and you've got all the people from the South moved there, and like the area where I lived in Westland, Wayne, Taylor, that was mostly people from Kentucky, Alabama, Georgia, all Southern people. So my neighborhood, and I look back at it, it's like I was with a bunch of hillbillies in the middle of Detroit. And because of that, there was everything. I mean, the city was really thriving on music, and there were bars, and there was no karaoke scene, you know, back when musicians could really cut your teeth, learn how to play with a band. See, I worry about that, the fact that all that's gone away.
Sure.
But there was a place to play.
Yeah, I mean, I think about it, even in my teenage years as a developing musician, it was easy to, we played gigs every weekend.
Yeah.
You know, keg parties, you know, whatever, bars, it was available.
And that's how, to me, that's how you learn. It's like you've got an idea, I'm going to play Friday night, man, I'm going to check it out. You might play it in all the wrong songs for that to work, but it's like, I've got it down.
Eventually you stumble on the right one.
Yeah, and you find, you know, it's all that stuff and the exploration that. But yeah, there was a ton of music. And then my father joined me into the union I started at 8, and then someone told him if you get... There was a local... To answer your question, there was a local scene. There was a guy named Casey Clark who had a local television morning show. And from that, the Osborne Brothers came. He had a Western swing, like with fiddles and all that. Wow. Buddy Emmons got picked up with Jimmy Dickens, picked Buddy up. Buddy came from... I can't forget where the city is, in Indiana, near Chicago. He came from there to work with Casey's band, and then Jimmy heard him and moved him to Nashville. But there was a scene. There were a lot of country musicians, even though that was not the focus of the town. And then there was all this great stuff, all these R&B players.
Sure,
so.
Sure. When did you start playing out? When did you start playing in those bars?
10.
Really?
Well, you could go to a club. Well, you could go to a club on the weekend, on Sundays. They called them family days. You've been to, you know how France is?
Sure.
And you go, go to Austria, and you know, at least when I went over there, it's like on Sundays, man, you're seeing all these kids run around, and the men are chugging them back. You know, we're having a great time.
I mean, it's funny, for country music, obviously, has especially at that time, had a really, like, wholesome image, but we all know the reality behind that image. I mean, you must have been exposed to some pretty rowdy behavior.
I remember being shuffled outside because they saw a fight was going to happen, I never knew the fight happened.
Get that kid out of here.
Yeah, it's like, somebody come here, come with me. And then I went back with them and my dad, and you know, but I started playing. I backed Johnny Paycheck at 11. I got embraced by all the old guard because they saw that, you know, here's this cute kid, but I could play what was on the radio by 11. Mm. And so I was playing all this stuff. And then back in those days, artists like Johnny Paycheck, Gene Shepherd, Billy Walker, they didn't have their own bands.
Right.
So they'd come in that area and they'd have what they called pickup bands, which is whoever the hot country band was, they'd hire them to go for their dates, whatever it was.
Would they send you like a set list in advance? How would that work? Or did you just have a songbook of like a ton of songs that you just knew?
No, they just, we knew that. I was, that's how I learned to play, was playing along with the radio. So I pretty much knew every steel part on every record, you know, close. Sometimes I couldn't figure it out, but I had it good enough, you know.
When a guy like Johnny Paycheck would come through town and use a pickup band, though, would he do like his, I mean, I imagine that would have been pretty early in his career. Yeah. Would he do his 3 singles and then like another 10 standards?
Yeah, standards.
Right.
You know, and you, typically they would come in and get in the back room huddle and like, hey, y'all know this? You know, and it's like we'd go from there. And then the show was put together. But, you know, that's what country music, it was just, you know, a club band with a bigger name, you know, fronting it, essentially.
So when did you decide to move to Nashville then?
Well, Barbara Mandrell's father came through, and I started coming to Nashville. They had a thing called the DJ convention, which was prior to the NAMM convention that musicians go.
Sure.
And they were just jam sessions. It was the perfect thing for a musician because all the record labels, it was all... coordinated with the birthday of the Grand Ole Opry. The weekend was the whatever that particular year was, 50th anniversary. And during 3 days prior to that, the record, they invited all the disc jockeys from all over the country, and they had open bars. Record labels, come up to K-Arc Records and listen to our artists. And it's like, here's a bottle of whiskey. And
right, yeah.
So
get them drunk these, and here's some new tunes.
And that's how they were doing it. And so you had there was about 4 hotels, and every floor of the hotel was jam sessions.
Mm.
And you had alcohol, and then you so all Fender, Gibson, and then of course all the instruments made in Nashville, and you know, and all the experimental. It was like the same thing as a NAMM show, but they were all in these hotels. And I saw Buddy Emmons and Jimmy Bryant jam.
Wow.
I saw, you know, I mean, this legendary jam sessions, you know, and they play for 3 or 4 hours straight and at the height of their game too, you know.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, yeah. It was a great time. And so I was coming to town
you're just
every year.
There, you're a kid and you're just soaking it up.
Well, and it's like it's a magnet. It's like I gotta do that.
Yeah.
So oddly enough, my dad joined me in the union and I started getting calls when Lay Lady Lay hit. In Detroit, Motown producers and things started looking for, we got to get a steel player.
Right.
And I was the only guy. I wasn't the good. I wasn't the best guy. I was just the only guy in the union. So I got cool sessions by default. And that also inspired the desire. Once I played on a hit record, and you know, like I think I was 16 when it came out, but there's an old bubblegum song by Gallery called It's So Nice to Be With You. Mm-hmm. And I got to play the solo on that. And, you know, and I got to play with great musicians, you know. James Jamerson played on this Jackson record that I did, and he was the musical director for Marvin Gaye.
Sure.
And so, and that was the entire Standing in the Shadows band of Motown.
And you're 16-year-old kid. Yeah,
well, I was 15 when I cut it.
Right.
And then and with that, and then Dennis Coffey was on that date. He heard me. He said, hey, I got this rock band. I want to do this little hit. And the guy sang kind of like Neil Diamond. So it kind of worked. And all he wanted was the melody. Well, that's a piece of cake for me. So sure. I went and played that melody. But then I wanted to do, because I learned with the radio, I wanted to do studio work. That was my thing.
Oh, so you were hoping to be a session dude.
Yeah, that's really what I wanted to do. Right. I didn't have the confidence to do it, but that was my focus.
Well, so when you moved here, you know, from all the artists that had come through Detroit that you'd played with, and, you know, your connections that you must have made, friendships you must have made when you were coming down here as a teenager, were you already pretty well connected?
I was well connected, but didn't use it.
Really?
Pete Drake, I met Pete Drake, who was the guy who played on Lay Lady Lay, played on Harrison's All Things Shall Come to Pass, or whatever the correct title.
Yeah, yeah.
He played on that record. He played on all of George Jones, Tam. I didn't even call Pete to 2 years after I was in town. And I called, hey, Pete, this is Paul. He said, why in the hell didn't you call me? And it was like he chewed me out. My first conversation was like, you know, because I didn't want to. I just wanted to come and see. And I didn't. My heroes were here, so sure. It was like, who was I to think that I could actually
get in on that work? Yeah,
yeah. I wanted to learn. It was a college for me.
What was Nashville like when you came to town? Was it have a? Did it have like a more sort of small town feel back then?
Much smaller than it is now. But last night meeting Dave Cobb. Dave's the type of producer that I remember back then, you know, who just lets it happen. It's like, okay, I know the energy and very, very excited about it. It seems like there was a lot of that and less about the corporate.
Right.
More about the music and less about the corporate thing. And
was it easier to sort of to, you know, for lack of a better word, network and meet people and meet other artists and stuff? Like, was because everyone was kind of hanging out at the same bars? And
oh, yeah. And it was open. If once you knew somebody, you know, like if they knew you weren't going to go in and disrupt the session, you could walk in off the street and watch a session.
Really?
Yeah. You could go in, you know, you might walk in and start a, and if they sensed you were a good person, and if inside George Jones was cutting, they'd go, yeah, just stand over there. And you just sit there and watch.
I mean, that's amazing. Unheard of nowadays.
Yeah, well, it's not that way now. You can't even get past the receptionist, you know, if you want to go up to see somebody in A&R or whatever. It was a small town in that sense.
Did you start getting session work right away, or were you playing around town?
No, I didn't. It was a few years after I called Pete Drake, you know. And he put my wife, I was starving, and I was down to like, I was making $80 a week with a kid and a wife, and we were just barely hanging on. And he said, does she work? So he put her to work as a booking his sessions, you know, and as receptionist.
Your wife?
My wife.
Wow.
Yeah. And
so was she throwing you a bone like, he can't do this one here?
No.
Come on, Paul. Get over there.
No, we talked about that. No, he did.
Oh,
he,
wow.
He took, you remember a band, Brewer and Shipley? They had One Toke Over the Line, Sweet Jesus, you know.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it was like a Southern rock kind of thing. When they were in town, I get this phone call from, this is the kind of things Pete would do. He'd call me because my dad works on guitar. Hey, Paul, get over here, man. What are you doing? My guitar's not working. So I show up, and Norbert Putnam, who's producing this thing, and a great bass player from Muscle Shoals and played on Elvis's record, you know, he's the producer. So I walk in and Pete's at his guitar. He said, sit down and check it out, man. It's just, I don't know what's wrong with it. Just play. And so I'm sitting there, I'm playing
So
like
he's throwing you a little softball to just get you playing in front of that producer.
And he goes in the control room, and so they're sitting there, and I guess, and then you'd say, hey, play that little thing that you did, you know, and like that, and see, because I tried to do that, and I couldn't get it to work. And so he had me just showing Norbert.
Right.
So I couldn't find, I said, man, I can't find anything wrong. I hit the talk back, and I can't find anything wrong with this. And Norbert says, you ready to do it? I said, what do you mean? He said, oh, Pete got sick. He left.
I mean, that's amazing. It's funny to hear that story. It's such a generous thing of Pete Drake to do.
Yeah.
And you would think that it would be the exact opposite. You would think that those guys wouldn't want some young buck to come in and get the opportunity to steal their gigs. That's incredible.
Yeah, well, he was very secure. And, you know, he did the talking guitar thing and had a hit with Forever. And you know, he produced Ringo Starr's Buku the Blues record.
Right.
And he was very secure within, you know, what he did. He was unique and he's the one that taught me, you know, he would give his late night lectures and he told me, he said, you're going to do good. He would point his finger in my face. You're going to do good in the sound. He said, but you better give back.
Hmm.
That's what he believed. He believed in you had to help. And I wasn't the only one that he helped. It's story after guitar players like Del Sellers and guys who went on to have great studio careers, Johnny Gimbel.
Right.
You know, I mean, he went on to help all kinds of musicians and other steel players, Larry Sasser, myself, Jimmy Crawford. He got Ben Keith the job with Neil Young.
I mean, do you think that that's an underlying influence of, say, maybe the motivation for you to start the online school that you're doing?
It's exactly that. You know, what happened? Well, two things happened. I was approached several years before that with, you know, this online streaming thing is the way instruments have to be taught in the future.
Right.
And it's just the way it is. You're not going to get a kid to sit down with a book or a DVD or a CD player, you know, and carry that around. But they're going to have their phone in their hand.
I use that stuff. I'm constantly searching YouTube for people showing the licks because I'm way more of a visual learner when it comes to music.
Yeah.
Than reading something out of a book. I could never get the feel right out of a book. Whereas if you just see somebody do it, you just see where their hand is. You go, oh, right, okay.
Oh, yeah. That's it. Yeah, and it becomes easier than the book. You know, when you try to put in words what you're actually doing, it becomes very complex. Whereas you go, you know,
I'm
we can all
this.
Throw a ball.
Right.
Think about all the actions and throwing a ball,
yeah,
and your
yeah.
wrist has to bend, you know, and you got, and so it's much easier. But that is the motivation. Two things, Buddy Emmons' death. Buddy became a recluse when his wife died, and I used to call him up trying to get him a sub for me, and you know, hey, why don't you come sub with the Time Jumpers? And he said, well, just keep calling, but he was not, you know, as it turned out, was not going to do it. But when he passed, I also talked to him about, you know, have you thought about teaching? Maybe that would be a way to get back into
right.
it, you know, might motivate you. But when he died, it just dawned on me, I'd been approached by another company and Brian Sutton's doing this one online and I thought, well, somebody's got to do this, because see, the way I play, I was taught by an Oahu method person,
right?
So the importance of the left hand for accuracy and tuning, all the things that people really do love about the instrument,
sure,
you have to, this is the most important, the left hand, the bar hand is the most important. When pedals came along, all of a sudden, you could press a couple pedals, and it did what the bar used to do.
Right.
And so, guys,
what do you call that? Slant bars.
Slanting. Right. But then people stop focusing in on the left hand, which is that's my primary focus. Even right, you know, today, no matter what I play, and it is Lloyd's. It is we only have a few masters left from that generation.
Sure.
J.D. Manis and they're young guys. I say young guys. But in the 50s and 60s that came through, that all play great. But I became very concerned, like, who's going to teach us? I looked at all the stuff that's on the net, and no disrespect to everybody. Everybody's trying to help. But the things that aren't taught are the most important. Like, someone has to say, no matter if it's easy to do with the pedals, you still need this. You're going to need this eventually, because think about Jeff Beck or yourself. I've heard you play. When you take and you bend a string, and it's like you decide to use more vibrato, a faster vibrato, short, all right. those little nuanced things. The steel is a very emotional instrument, no matter what level you play it at, whether it's, you know, the Daniel Lanois stuff or whatever, you still got to, you got to milk it, you know,
yeah,
you got to.
Pitch and, is like the, yeah. that is like such a deciding factor. Even guys that don't have tons of licks, yeah. I'd still like to hear if they pitch it right.
Yeah, if you know? Yeah, it's because it's a beautiful sounding instrument, and sure. if you can get it in tune. And so that's what I thought, somebody's got to do it for my generation. And I, it's my way of giving back, because if I can just lay out what I know and all the instruction on my instrument. The other thing that surprised me, and I didn't realize it, because I've been doing, you know, I've cut with Megadeth and I've cut with different, you know, John Mayer and different things through the years. And I've been doing great. So I think the steel guitar is evolving. Then I went back and looked at it. They're still telling people to get a book written in 1970 on pedal steel, which is great for the time.
Sure.
But it's like, what about everything that happened
well,
since
what
the
about
70s?
The last 40 years?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and look at the same would be true on guitar with all the tapping
sure.
and all the, you
right,
know, all the
yeah,
things
yeah.
that are now part of, you know, a modern culture,
right.
musical culture.
Right.
And so I felt like if I don't do it, who will? And
yeah.
I talked to Lloyd and he said he didn't, he's 80 years old. He's not going to do it. And a few of my buddies and nobody, and I thought, I've got to do it. I have no choice. You
well,
know?
It's funny that yeah I was going to ask you this. Do you think that there are enough young up and comers to fill those shoes of guys like Lloyd that are, you know, not going to be here?
Mm-hmm.
To, yeah, I hate to be morbid, but you know,
no,
like
no,
as guys are aging out, you know, are there enough people coming into it? It seems like a very niche. Thing, you know, and probably always was, I'm guessing,
yeah.
but do you think with the accessibility of what you're doing online that they'll be like, you know, that
yeah.
will be the catalyst for a new generation of steel players?
Well, you look at most of the steel players that are really good and you know, from, are they're like 40s up, and there aren't a lot. There are a few guys coming along that are younger. There are a lot of young people playing steel.
Right. Well, okay. It probably takes like 20 years to get any good at it. Well,
but it really doesn't. But it really doesn't. It does if you go with what exists out there,
right,
because there's
right.
there's no single thread to go. You go from here to here to here to here. What I lucked into was getting the teacher I had, Wanda Bruning, who was... She told my father, I don't play pedal steel, and we had already ordered a Fender 400, and she taught Hawaiian. She said, I'll tell you what I'll do. She said, I'll teach him. I did a trial lesson. She said, let me see if he's got talent. So we did that, and then she said, I'm going to teach him. She said, I'm going to teach him how to teach himself. And so she taught me intervals. She taught me all this. Like, I wanted to learn. I remember specifically, like she said, I'm going to teach you a song. And so I said, can I learn this song by Buck Owens? I forget what song it was.
Yeah.
And she said, no, honey, no. She said, I'm going to teach you what you need to learn.
Right.
And you can teach yourself
yeah.
Buck Owens. And she taught me, I
that's
learned.
That's like how when I first started taking guitar, I wanted to learn how to play Crazy Train by Ozzy Osbourne. But luckily, my teacher taught me a few scales and some root chords.
Yeah, gave you.
Turned
yeah.
out to be better in the long run.
Yeah, it was not what I wanted, but what I needed. That's what she would say. And that's her quote. Honey, I'm going to teach you what you need, not what you want.
I got to remember that. That's
yeah.
good. I'm going to use that on my kids.
Oh, it's great. But and because of that, you know, and that's what I decided. Like, I've just finished, I'm going to be putting out a beginner's course from this course, just an excerpt, so that a guy that's just at that level can just go and dissect it, so he isn't distracted by things that are maybe where he shouldn't look
right,
at the
right.
moment, and just get this down first. And so, and it's basically all of that stuff, you know, and then you go from there, then you can get in and you can learn whatever you want. Then you can go play a gig.
Right.
You know, and that's essentially, if you've got all that, you don't even have to know a song. Like you asked me when I played my first gig, I didn't know a song. What I did was I knew little things. Like I knew how to go from a C to a F.
Oh.
And I knew how to go from a C to a D minor.
Right.
And I knew how, this is what she taught me. She said, these songs are broken down like this.
Right.
And so
when
she
you
said,
hear the one go to the flat seven, you know it's going to the four chords,
yeah.
so you could jump there.
So all of a sudden I could back up, you know, and I just play, and she said, just play simple. She said, just do this, and which was basically padding.
Right.
So when
right.
I was 11, man, I was sitting there just doing what she told me, and the old men are going, hey, this kid is good, you know, because I wasn't messing things
right,
up,
yeah.
And I was kind of going along, and then I'd learn when it come to one of the things I'd learned on the radio. That's how I got my song base. You know, I had an intro to this song,
sure.
And then all of a sudden I could play that little intro
little
when it came to solo.
And stuff, yeah.
And then they were, you know, everybody just kind of took me under their wing, but also I had a language. I could speak in intervals. I could, you know, she taught me to read, but she said, more importantly, you need to know the intervals, because
right.
I told her country players didn't read.
Ah.
And so she said, okay, well, then you're going to do this. And so I could, if I got with a great keyboard player or whatever, and they played a chord I didn't know,
yeah.
I'd say, what is that? And then they'd give it to me in intervals. And then I go, oh, I got to have a pedal for that.
So I can throw this one over, yeah.
Yeah, or I can't get that.
Right.
And then she also told me when you can't get all, because Hawaiian players could not play full voice chords.
Sure.
So she said, you just play the strongest notes.
Oh.
And so as a kid, and it's interesting, this whole thing, and what I look back at it, and I think, well, Dad, she saved me time. Because, you know, you can learn 15 tunes, 15 songs, and if nobody really breaks it down for you...
Right, you don't really know what you're playing.
You don't know what you're playing. You've got 15 songs. Now show me another song. You're sitting there with, duh, well, what do I do now? Because you have no mechanism to move forward.
There you go. You heard it here first, kids. Learn just a little bit of theory. It goes a long way, let me tell you.
In the conversation, too.
Okay, so how did you wind up getting your first road gig, touring gig, was Barbara Mandrell, right?
Yes.
How'd that come about?
Well, just in playing back in Paycheck, and her father was a Moss Wright guitar rep, and he was coming through the area, and he happened to go to the show where one of these artists was, and I was a steel player backing him, and he, you know, I want your number. I got a girl, you know, that plays steel too.
Right.
And she's going to be big. He was telling my dad. And of course, you know, we didn't think much of that.
Sure.
But when they kept tabs on me, you know. And so when I was 17, I was in my 11th grade. And they said she got signed with Columbia Records. And they said Earlene, their daughter that played drums, is taking correspondence school. Would you consider doing that? And of course, my parents said no. And I thought, oh, I'm going. I'm gone.
Right.
I'm gone.
Right. Yeah.
This is a job. This is Nashville. And so I argued and convinced them to let me do the correspondence school.
Hmm.
So I left 3 months into my senior year.
So that would have been like her first touring as well.
It was her. Right. She just had her first single was a country version of Do Right Woman. She named her band, which I hated, Barbara Mandrell and the Do Rights. That sounds like something out of Spinal Tap. You
totally.
Know, like,
well, here's a question for you. I mean, for people listening that aren't familiar with Barbara Mandrell, she was a singer, but she also played the pedal steel herself.
Yes.
How come there aren't more pedal steel players? Like, I honestly can't think of any besides Barbara Mandrell. I'm sure there must be some out there. But
you know, that's the thing. It's like certain instruments appeal to, I think, that's a growing thing, because there's a girl in London, Sarah Jory, and there was a Porter Wagoner had an all-girl band. And so he had a steel player. And there was Donna Hammett, who played with Bill Anderson. And there's about maybe a dozen or so girl steel players in Nashville. But I think the whole bulky carrying in, you know, the thing's heavy. I don't mean that it's chauvinistic,
right.
But when you look at all the amps and all the stuff, and then you look at a violin,
right.
And you look at, you know, it's just, there's things that are just seem more, you know, magnetic to a woman.
Sure, sure.
And that's true with young kids, too. You know, they see that. They'd rather pick up a guitar, something that's easy to carry, than look at that big contraption, you know?
Yeah. Or now just, you know, play with a computer.
Yeah, that's right. Not learn anything.
Right, exactly.
Air guitar.
Yeah, there you go. GarageBand.
Yeah.
For people listening that don't know, can you talk a little bit about, like, all the artists you've backed up on the road and in the studio? I mean, there's just... The list goes on and on and on.
Well, okay, outside of...
Like, who are the primary ones? Who are the ones that you were the most you know,
prominent?
Associated with or well, worked the most with?
I've done almost all of George Strait records, almost all of Alan Jackson's, and pretty much all of Shania's records. I got really lucky. I got into camps with producers that were really popular, but it's pretty hard. And I don't mean this egotistically. It's just that I started doing major session work in the 80s with George Strait, was the first major artist that having hits. But I did Rodney Crowell, and I mean, I did. It's easier for me to say I didn't record with Buck Owens,
right?
and I actually got to record with Johnny Cash on a duet, and I recorded on Ray Price's last record. But I pretty much everybody that was on my bucket list in Nashville from the old and the modern generation. Now there are some new acts that I haven't recorded with,
sure.
But I do Thomas Rhett, Brett Young,
right?
You know,
still working all the time out here.
This kid that's the rave, Mason Ramsey, that just did Ellen.
Oh, yeah.
He's got like 2 million followers on Instagram. We just recorded him this week. So,
oh wow,
yeah. So I feel like, but I toured with the Dire Straits. I did the last Dire Straits tour. I did the Notting Hill tour. Worked with Mel Tillis, Jerry Reed. Dottie West, and then I played, just with jazz people. Earl Klugh, when he came into town during the 80s, it never got released, but we got to do that. And I've always pursued that as well, because I always study what I want to be ready for any call that you might get.
Sure.
You know, and I think that's the new...
It's got to be fun doing things that are a little off the beaten path. Like you mentioned a minute ago that you recorded with Megadeth. I mentioned that.
Yeah,
that's got to be pretty unusual.
Yeah. Do you know Dan Huff? You know, he's guitar. He was in L.A. For a while, and he played on one of Michael... After Van Halen did Beat It, I believe it was, they wanted guys with that kind of chops.
Sure.
And so he was a studio guy. He played for Quincy and Michael on the Bad record. And anyway, he moved to Nashville. He's one of our leading country producers.
Oh, wow.
And so he got the call to do Megadeth because of his connection with Mutt Lange and all that thing. And somehow that got thrown in his lap. And so they're in, Dave Mustaine is here in Nashville. And Dan said, you know, it'd be really cool to put a couple of Nashville guys on this record. I got called, you know. No, I only got listed in the special thanks area because you can't be listed as a musician. But anyway, I put steel guitar, and I did it on an intro.
Oh, okay.
And it's like, it sounds, everybody thinks it's a guitar.
Sure.
Where I'm running through tons of stuff, and it's just a slide kind of thing. And that's all did it. And Ron Huff put some strings on, and there was keyboards put on that.
Right.
The next album they came to do with Dan, Dave said, you know, you can make it sound a little bit more like a steel. So I got to play through a Leslie, and it's cool. And yeah,
soon, Megadeth's tribute to classic honky tonk. Yeah. That's
well,
the next record.
You know what? I mean, he was a good patron of the town. He fell in love with Nashville, and he allowed a little of that culture to sift into their music destroying what they were about.
Well, how far back do you go with Vince Gill? I mean, I know that you play with him, like you tour with him all the time now, right? But like, have you guys been...
I met Vince when he was in Pure Prairie League. You know, he just left. And he played on Dave Grisman record with our fiddle player from the band, Jim Buchanan. So Jim knew him, and he said, hey, why don't you come out? We're playing Knott's Berry Farm. And so Vince came out, and we hit it off. You know, he played me some demos he was doing, and he was kind of wandering. You know, he wasn't sure if he liked Nashville, wasn't sure if he's going to head that way or whatever. And so anyway, fast forward a few years, he moves to Nashville, and I get this phone call. Hey, buddy, it's Vince. I got some demos. You want to play on them? And I went and played with Tony Brown, his producer.
Mm.
And on those demos was Nobody Answers When I Call Your Name demo. So I played on that. And then I get the call to play on his record. Now, he had done a couple records in Nashville with Barry Beckett. And they'd done a few things that weren't. And this was kind of like going to be his last... hurrah.
His last chance.
Yeah. Well, you don't know. I mean, it's like, you know, once you have two or three things that don't do it, you know, nobody knows. But you sense that. And so he was going to do what he wanted to do.
Right.
I'm going to do my own songs. Everybody's trying to steer him away from doing his own songs.
Sure.
And you know, the fans dictate the final hurrah because they like the way he wrote. And they
clearly
took to his songs. Yeah, clearly. And the rest is history. But we met on that record. I was so busy in the studio, I couldn't tour. You know, he asked me, would you consider? And I did one show up in Gatlinburg, one off show with Willie Weeks. He just got Willie to go out with him. But I was just too busy. I couldn't do it. I was afraid to leave town.
Right. I'm
afraid of losing my work.
Sure.
And so so we've known each other since that time. And then he joined the Time Jumpers. I took his, he had a great steel player. When I didn't do it, he took out John Huey, who had played on all the Conway Twitty records.
Oh, wow.
And which is the style that I had kind of emulated on the solo on I Don't Call Your Name. Nobody answers. But anyway, John passed away. And so he was in this Western swing band called the Time Jumpers.
Sure.
And I never played Western swing music in my life, but I studied jazz, I studied bebop, I've heard Western swing all my life, but, you know, nothing much past San Antonio Rose did play.
Yeah, sure.
It's the one club token song. And so anyway, I joined the band. And then a year later, Vince joined the band. It blew everybody's mind in town. Well, you know, you're a superstar. Why are you joining a local band?
Right. Yeah.
And he's been there. I think
just
he's
loves
seven.
To play. Right.
He loves to play, and it's like it's like what I believe in. It's like you have to. There's all of these elements that cause you to be you and the thing that people know you for.
Right.
But it's all the study and the diversity. You know, grabbing this from here, you know, from all over left field and all there. And that's what Vince is doing, and that's what I did. So we joined this band, and not knowing that we would do a record, and we ended up touring. We did about 30 dates last year, about 40 the year before, you know, and we're all too old, man, to tour. No, I mean, we were going to tour with Vince, you know, and do his dates. And, of course, Vince is out with the Eagles right now, so...
Right. Well, how did the Bakersfield album come about?
Well, it's weird. We played this old club, historic club for bluegrass, the Station Inn. And everybody, for some reason, everybody had left. And it's just Vince and I loading out last. And so we just sat down on the porch together. And he said, hey, buddy, you got a second? I'd like to talk to you. And I said, yeah. So we sat down and he said, man, I want to do an album. And I'm thinking, okay, we're going to do an instrumental album.
Right.
And we sat down, and the way I felt about, I didn't feel like, well, I'm not a singer. I can't really contribute. And he said, no, I want to do it. And he had this vision of a singer like, you know, Buck Owens had Don Rich, Ernest Tubb had Billy Burr. You know, it's like Take It Away Leon and all that. And he's always had a fondness for that connection.
Sure.
And that's what he described. He said, you know, he said, I want to do it with I love the steel. It's his favorite instrument, steel guitar. I want you to be the vocalist with your instrument.
Mm.
And so that was intriguing. And we talked about because he's a monster guitar player.
Oh yeah.
And you know, and he could play. We could make any kind of record we wanted to. You could do a Larry Carlton or a rock record, a blues record, whatever you want. He said, we'll play on it, you know, but he's like, I don't want to do instrumentals. And I didn't either.
Right.
I don't really, that's not something I love doing.
Sure.
I just do it when I have to. But so that's how it came to be. And so I said, you know, Vince, I'll just play on your record. I'll do it.
We can just do it. I mean, it's awfully generous. I don't want to diminish your role in it at all. But, you know, for a guy of his stature.
Extremely.
To put somebody else's name on the record is, you know, that's pretty wild.
Oh, it's never.
That's a huge show of respect.
Yeah, well. And
to what you're doing.
I don't know if that's ever been done, but that's the way I viewed it. I thought, you know, this is like. You know,
I mean, was the Bakersfield sound always one of your obsessions in country music?
Yes, it was. And that's, here's the interesting thing. He's from Oklahoma. I'm in Detroit. And we're just a few years apart. He's I'm 4 years older than Vince. And we still, at that, he started playing when he was young. His first, Buck Owens was his first thing, and Merle Haggard.
Right.
And my first pedal steel guitar album my dad bought, you know, once I got the instrument, he bought me Year for Me for Buck Owens.
Oh, really?
So I'm listening.
Is that Mooney?
That's Mooney, yeah.
Did you ever get to hang with Mooney at all?
Oh, yeah, yeah. He was a wild one. Mooney was, he was a rock and roller, man. Telling you, he could have hung with anybody. But yeah, he was great. But anyway, so that's where we both started. And we realized in doing that, and he said, well, man, I've always, and that satisfied so many. When we talked about that, you know, Merle Haggard and Buck Owens, it was like, well, there we are. Let's just do half of one song. You know, that's a catalog. And we both like the early stuff because we thought the bridge into any artist is their beginnings.
Right.
You know, and not that we were doing it for that reason, but we thought, let's bring that stuff forward because everybody's going to remember, you know, the later stuff. But it's like that's the old stuff tends to get forgotten. So we grabbed the old stuff. Yeah, we're getting ready to do another one on focusing in on George Jones, Jimmy Dickens, Ray Price, and Conway Twitty.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we're gonna, and the same thing. Go back and grab that stuff but yeah, it is extremely generous.
I want
generous
you to know, I bought that Starday book you were talking about yesterday.
You did?
Yeah.
Oh,
was Starday a Texas label? Well, they were George Jones's label, right?
Well, Starday actually is in Madison, Tennessee. Don Pierce, it's the collective efforts of three people. And Don Pierce was, he had lived in L.A., I believe it was, and running a label. And so he already knew how to make that work. And then they had the guy, the pappy guy that owned all the jukeboxes. And then the other guy was a publisher, I believe, kind of, I forget what his deal was.
Mm.
But he knew how to manipulate the jocks and, you know, I mean, they had it. They had a machine, man.
Right.
And they were just there to catch all those dropped artists like George Jones and you know, Gene Shepherd, Porter Wagner, and all them as Nashville really did go pop.
Right.
Yeah.
That's an interesting part of country music history. And you see this, not just in country, but in sort of all genres, the role of those old school indie labels. At the time, that all those guys got their starts on.
Yeah, it's amazing because without them, you know, and I wonder, you know, this is just me pondering, but I wonder if we're not primed for that right now because when you look at YouTube, you're a YouTube guy.
Yeah,
and I'm seeing stuff that I'm thinking there's no place for this to live. But
right,
but
I think that is happening. I mean, I think that's what, you know, if you look at like labels like 30 Tigers and stuff that are putting out all the sort of the Americana, you know.
I do. I see it happening, and I wonder if that's not the way. I guess my point was if that's not the way, it's going to all go back down, shrink back down into.
Right.
You know, and like here's the thing that I loved about Starday, and the same things was true with Rounder and Sugar Hill and all these eclectic, nuanced labels, is when you saw the label there, if you didn't know the name of the artist, you go, this is probably really good.
Mm-hmm.
And so you
totally.
You took a gamble.
Yeah, because you trusted that logo.
Because you knew they represent something, you know, they're looking for the stuff. And I think that, you know, that could be a, you know, a future for, I hope it is.
Yeah. So I know you have like a string set through
D'Addario.
Through D'Addario. How'd that come about? What is that? What's specific about that?
Well, what's specific in my quest, you know, for the first for the best sonic value in a track, you know, sometimes a string, if it's too thin, it can be the G sharp note on a steel guitar is a really high note, and guys were putting 10s and 11s. So when you see sets, you see a 10 and 11 in there. And so I had gone to a 12, and then like for a 14, which is also twangy for the E note, I've got 15s. And so
you like them heavy.
Well, I got them heavy so that so as you go up the neck, if you want to get screaming, it's still got some body.
Right.
You know, and so, and so I was a guy that always had to buy, I bought a set of whatever, and then had to get individual strings to get to create my own set.
I imagine in Nashville, you could probably go to, you know, any old guitar store and get specific pedal steel strings, but I imagine that you can't, I mean, most places that wouldn't be the case. Like, I don't recall ever seeing that at my local shop.
No. Right? Well, and actually, after Showbud left downtown, you couldn't get into Nashville. You know, there was a few.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean,
that is surprising.
There was a Steel Guitar World store for a while, and you could buy strings there, but they didn't deal with every string. And see, I like, a lot of times what happens with the boutique strings, they buy them and they sit there for a long time, so you get aged strings, and I want the good stuff.
The good fresh stuff.
And so D'Addario, I had been using their strings a long time on my own, and we were doing an All for the Hall show, and I met their rep, Tom, and he gave me a set, and I said, man, I really love this. Do they do this? And I started talking to him about what I liked, and so I endorsed their strings, the NYXLs, I think they're called 1238 pedal steel, PS for pedal steel, and got them to do these. They came out with a great string that lasts, and I like nickel. Most steel guitar string companies are doing stainless steel, and they're too brittle sounding for the instrument's brittle to begin with.
Right.
So you want everything you add to it, you want it to warm it up.
Right.
So it can, you know, and then you can get the twangy edge when you need it, but because that's just EQ. Anyway, they came up with that set, and I was amazed, you know, after I kept on. And what they found is everybody was like, as I would talk about the gauge, everybody's going, hey, I want those gauges. So they started seeing that there's a market for a new gauging system for steels, and so they came up with my gauge, and they're doing really well. A lot of guys have switched to now using a 12, now using a 15 for their ease, and noticing it gives them a little oomph, to their playing, especially when you hit the strings hard in a twangy string. It can also go sharp. That's the other deal.
Yeah.
And so, you know.
I mean, for people listening that aren't familiar with the instrument, I mean, it is a nightmare to tune those things.
Oh, they're, yeah.
And I don't really play. I mean, we've talked about this a little bit, but, you know, I own one and doink around with it. And I'm going to definitely dive into your online stuff when I get a break in August. But just my attempts to even tune that freaking thing it's not easy.
And it's a constant struggle you have, because essentially what you're doing for the guitar players out there, they'll get it. What if you were using your whammy bar for everything you played?
Right.
And you're going down a whole octave. Those strings wear out real fast if you do that. They just, you know, the technology. And so that's what we struggle with. And then there are metal parts. On the more metal you put on a guitar, the harder it is to tune.
Heard it here first, kids. Yep. Paul Franklin says we should all put Floyd Roses on our pedal steels.
Yeah. Actually, yeah, that's what. But I have a speaker too. That Eminence was great to. I helped them with trying to go back to what I'm a study of old records.
Mm.
And, you know, like Together Again was cut on an old Jensen kind of a basement amp, you know, the old speakers, but they couldn't handle the volume. And so what happened through the years is that they got volume, but they didn't maintain the tone of some of those old speakers, like the old JBLs and all that. But you want a little bit of breakup.
Sure.
And so I was thinking, yeah, we got to get, there's got to be a fine line to keep it clean when we want it, but you want a little hair,
right?
You know?
It's probably breaking up on the amp a little bit, but it's maybe breaking up through the console a little bit. Maybe it's a little bit of everything.
Yeah,
right?
It's a little bit of everything. Maybe hitting the cone and, you know, the speaker, the microphone. But it's just, there's a balance of great things. So you want your amp not to be sterile clean, because then it's countering everything. It's just, you find that fine balance. And it took them about a year, but they came up with a speaker. And it's just, everybody's raving. Here's the way I test gear. Okay, because I work on a lot of records and with the best engineers. I never announce I've got anything new, you know, and my cabinets are always looking the same because they're little Walter cabinets. But I put the new speaker and didn't say a word. And I went over there and I'll never forget, but Justin Kneebanks and a couple of the engineers I really trust, each one of them independently, what'd you do with your, Paulie, have you done something different? And I'm going, well, why? No, it's great. I was just trying to, And I said, well, there's a new speaker. And so that's when I know I've got something, you know. And I've had the reverse of that. You know, there's been a lot of things that I thought should sound great.
Right.
And I bring them
and
in.
It just doesn't work.
And they'll go, hey, can you bring this back? Go bring your other rig back in.
What was the thing you said last night? I don't think this song calls for that.
Yeah. I don't hear me on this song.
All right, man. Thank you for coming today. Appreciate you coming and doing this on a Saturday when you probably, you know, you've got lawns to mow.
Yeah. Oh yeah. You know that I was telling Chris last night, I just my hands, if you guys weed eat a lot, you'll know this, you shouldn't weed eat and play a steel guitar.
Well, seriously, thank you for coming and doing that yesterday, man. You
know, oh, man.
You jumped in there and
I
saved
love it.
Us,
yeah.
I appreciate it.
But anyway.
All right, that was pedal steel guitar legend Paul Franklin. You know, I forgot to mention in the ramble before the interview that Paul plays all the pedal steel on my new record. And it was kind of a last minute thing because originally it was going to be Robbie Turner who played on my last record. But Robbie, unfortunately, was having some health issues that week. He's fine now, but he was in rough shape there for a couple of days. And so I knew I was planning on interviewing Paul Franklin on like the Saturday. And so I just texted him on Friday and I was like, hey, man, are you around tonight? Could you come in and throw down some steel? And he did. And it's killer. And he kind of saved us that week. Very, very cool. I loved, and working with him was just a total treat. He's a real cool guy and a total pro and just a ripper on his instrument. And I'm going to put up some links to some different things we talked about, including the online course that he has started. So go to walkingthefloor.com to check that out and, you know, go sign up and become a pedal steel aficionado yourself. All right, that's it for this week. We'll be back in a couple weeks. I think I'm going to finally post my interview with Michael Monroe, rock and roll legend, lead singer from Hanoi Rocks and all sorts of solo records, and he's still going strong. And he's my buddy, and I interviewed him last summer, and I'm going to finally get that posted. So check it out. That's it for this week. We'll see you soon. Adios, amigos!